Hi, friend. We wanted to make sure you knew about our brand new reading group that's happening this January. The five Thursday evenings in January, we're going to have our very own Morgan Bird going through his very own book on the abstract of principles called Roots of Our Faith. So if you're interested in learning more about confessional theology, particularly Baptist theology, do check this reading group out. It's going to be a great time, full of quality discussion. So don't miss out. If you're interested, check the link in the description to our reading groups and find out more. And as always, you can contact us if you have any questions. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's all about serious thinking for a serious church. And thinking seriously, we want to hopefully encourage and cultivate an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, cheerful confessionalism. So what that ends up meaning, if you're a brand new listener, is that we talk to all sorts of people about all sorts of topics, and we try to do it appropriately within the confines of this sort of, like, I don't know, for lack of a better word, intellectual culture or phrase, I guess. And so we try to be kind towards other people, be interested in what they say and why they think it, read what they write, ask good questions, ask clarifying questions, not in a sense of being suspicious, but in the helpful sense of being curious. So not like vain curiosity or curiosity that's intentionally trying to push the boundaries, but curiosity because you respect another person and you value them and you say, you know what, you have something worthwhile to hear and listen to, and I want to hear it and understand it. And maybe I think you're totally wrong, but that's okay. That's part of the value of just respecting another person. But we also want to do it and understand the very best argument. So we want to hear from the experts in the field on their areas, and we want to talk to them about it. Whether we agree with them or not, we want to know the very best information. So that's a long-winded way of talking about the show. On today's episode, which you're really interested to hear, is Dr. Zach Williams, who we have with us. We're going to be talking about Abraham Booth and sanctification and justification and salvation, and all sorts of fun stuff related to that. The title of what we're looking at is Zach's freshly printed dissertation, not printed, I guess, yet, but I've got it here on the PDF, and it's A Distinguished Blessing of Grace, Abraham Booth's Doctrine of Sanctification in Confessional Context. So I'm excited. This is going to be fun. Zach, before we get started, can you tell me just a little bit about yourself, and then what was it that was first told you, like, I need to study Booth compared to anybody else you could study for however many years you're working on this?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me, Jordan. Truly honored to be on the show. A little bit about myself. I am originally from Mississippi, grew up in small town Mississippi. Blessed to grow up in a Christian home, Christian parents. And so around when I was kind of in college, I kind of set down a path of Christian ministry. And that brought me in 2017 to Louisville, Kentucky to study at Southern Seminary. And I've been here since then in 2017. Did my MDiv here from 2017 to 2020. And then when I came to seminary, never really had the intention of doing a PhD. My idea was to, you know, do 3 years of an MDiv, go back home to Mississippi and be involved in pastoral ministry in a church there. But around 2019, really started sensing that the Lord was pushing me to pursue further studies, specifically in Baptist history, in that field. I remember one of the key kind of factors that pushed me in that direction was Michael Haken, who's my supervisor. His History of the Baptist class that I took in 2018 at the MDiv level at Southern. He made a statement that kind of stuck with me. He said, you know, talking about a lot of these figures from Baptist history, you know, many of them obscure. We don't know much about them. If their name is known, little is known about them. And he said in that class, he said, you know, if anybody is going to do work on these people and recover them, which they are worth recovering, you know, I would argue many of them. If anybody's going to recover these figures, it's going to have to be us. You know, it's going to have to be the Baptists. The Anglicans aren't going to do it. The Presbyterians aren't going to do it. The only people who are going to be interested in these people are Baptists. And, you know, many of these people lived in relative obscurity, but lived incredible lives of faithfulness to the gospel. really a testament to the grace of God and are worth recovering. And so that statement that Dr. Haken made, I'm sure I've talked to him about this. Maybe I haven't, but that one statement was really one, kind of one factor that really, really set me down a path to thinking about doing a PhD in Baptist studies, specifically Baptist history. So, and around 2019, late 2019, when I was really considering pursuing that area of study at a doctoral level, what led me specifically to Booth, you know, Michael Haken likes to say that, I've heard him say before that one of his spiritual gifts is helping people come up with dissertation topics. he always has ideas rolling around in his head that he wants other people to pursue. And so, so I just asked him when I was considering this, I said, Dr. Haken, give me a list of about five or six names of people that you think need more work done, in early Baptist history. And, Booth was one of those names. He mentioned a few others. John Fawcett was one of them. There's still very little done on John Fawcett and others like that. But, Booth was, one that he mentioned. And what initially drew me to Booth, I think, were his, it was a handful of things, but first of all, his writings on ecclesiology were one. He was a staunch defender of Baptist distinctives in the 18th century, of doctrine of believers' baptism by immersion. He wrote a book, excellent little book called Essay on the Kingdom of Christ, in which he defends congregational church government and separation of church and state. So it was works like that that initially drew me to Booth. And I was also just very impressed by his legacy of personal piety and holiness. Booth was a figure who was almost universally respected in his day. And a part of that was because he was a man of sterling character and of staunch personal piety. And so that was another thing that drew me to Booth. Tossed around a few different ideas of what exactly I wanted to write on with Booth. But as I was drawing, as I was finishing up comprehensive exams around 2 years ago, and then just kind of really trying to nail down a topic, I became really interested in the doctrine of sanctification just at a broad level, just in general, and knew that Booth had written a lot on the doctrine of sanctification. And so it led me to the question, okay, how does Booth contribute to an understanding of the doctrine of sanctification from a distinctively Calvinistic reform perspective? And so that led me to this question of Booth's doctrine of sanctification. And specifically, one thing that I wanted to do with this project is put him in conversation with some older reform thinkers in England. And so that was one area that this took, was kind of, in one sense, it was a little bit of Baptist reception of the Reformed tradition as it specifically related to the doctrine of sanctification. So that's how I ended up where I am, and that's where we are today.
That's awesome. So if you're listening, you know, we've got a wide range of listeners, so I'm going to speak for just like 10 seconds to those who are wanting to do PhDs. You got a nice little glimpse on how to do one appropriately, by the way Zach just described it, putting old figures in conversation with other ones and thinking about a topic. So like, you've just got like basically got all the ingredients there to do a historical theology PhD. Now, it's funny, Zach, you mentioned that story that Haken has shared about, you know, if Baptists don't care about this, who is going to? And I like to think part of what we're doing here is hopefully telling other people that, hey, Baptists matter. You may not be in the Baptist tradition, but this matters. But it's amazing how important that story is, because I've heard several other people share that exact same story for why they became interested in Baptist history. So eventually we'll need to have a book dedicated to just Michael Haken and his influence on all a generation of Baptist historians. But anyway, tell me a little bit more about Booth, his own historical context, why he's so important. If you're a listener to the podcast, you've probably heard of Booth. We did, if you're a regular listener, like from the very beginning, We had one of the very first episodes was on Abraham Booth with our friend Morgan Bird. And that was the first time I ever learned anything about Abraham Booth. And I was like, oh, I like this guy. So tell me a little bit about him, Zach.
Yeah, so Abraham Booth, for those who don't know, is an 18th century Baptist, English Baptist. His dates are 1734 to 1806. And so he kind of lives in this, a little bit of an interesting period in English Baptist history where he's kind of situated one generation between figures like John Gill, who John Gill's born in the late 17th century, dies in 1771. So he kind of lives one generation after someone like Gill, but then one generation before later figures of 18th century Baptist history, such as Andrew Fuller, William Carey, kind of that generation that is associated with the evangelical revival. Now, Booth is a contemporary of all those people. He overlaps significantly with him, but he is one generation older than those men. And so he's born in a little village called Blackwell that is about 75 miles due north of the city of Birmingham, northwest of Nottingham. Much of his early life is spent kind of in that region that's northwest of Nottingham. When he's less than a year old, his family will move to another little village called Annesley Woodhouse, and they're farmers, essentially. So he comes from a very humble background and upbringing. Couldn't really have much in the way of formal education. He had some schooling here and there. When he was young, early teens, he was apprenticed to a stocking weaver. And so he was able to work some and kind of have some classes, you know, and education here and there as he can afford it. But for the most part, he doesn't have much, if anything, in the way of formal education. And so he grows up most of his early life in Annesley Woodhouse. He's a farmer. At the age of, or when he was in his teens, so let me backtrack a little bit. So Booth's parents were members of the established church in England. They were Anglicans, but pretty nominal members. They didn't attend church much. And so for all effective purposes, he didn't really grow up in a Christian home. But when he was 15 years old, a group of itinerant preachers visited his village. They were known as the Barton Preachers. They were a group of General Baptist itinerant preachers, so they're Arminian in their convictions. They're based out of a little village called Barton in the Beans, which is not far from Booth's home area. And they visit his town when he's sometime in his mid-teens, probably. And under their preaching, he is converted. And so in 1755, he's in his early 20s, he's baptized at Barton. He will kind of devote himself fully to the cause of the Barton preachers. He becomes a General Baptist. He preaches at a General Baptist congregation in a place called Kirkby Woodhouse. And he kind of devotes himself wholeheartedly to the theology of the General Baptist. He tells us later that when he was, during these days, he was very passionate about the soteriology of the General Baptist. So he was very dedicated to an Arminian position. He even writes a poem that is titled Eternal Predestination, in which he basically lambasts the doctrine of predestination from a Calvinistic perspective. One of my great regrets is that we don't have a copy of this. I would love to read the poem just to see his early perspective on these matters during those days, but the poem's been lost to history, it seems. If I had my guess, I would imagine if any copies did survive, he probably burned them later in life, because he did look back on that poem with a lot of regret and basically talked about how foolish he was for writing it. So initially, Booth becomes a Christian in the context of the General Baptist, and he is in his early years of his ministry, he's a General Baptist. When he is 23 years old, he marries a lady named Elizabeth Beaumar, and they move to a little bit bigger town village called Sutton and Ashfield, which is just outside of Nottingham, just to the northwest. And around 1763, for reasons that we do not know, he has a dramatic shift in his soteriology, and he comes to embrace the theology of the particular Baptist. As I said, we know nothing of the reason for that. He doesn't give us any indication as to why this happened. We have no detail as to why this happened. But at least by 1763, he had fully embraced the more Calvinistic theology of the particular Baptist. Shortly after, he registers a particular Baptist congregation at Sutton in Ashfield called Boar's Hall. Prior to that, him and his wife had opened a school where they were teaching children there. But he does register a particular Baptist congregation at Sutton in Ashfield called Boar's Hall. And so his ministry during the 1760s takes place in that context. And during that time, Booth preached a series of sermons on the doctrines of grace that will really kind of transform the course of his life in ways that he couldn't have foreseen. And so he preaches a sermon series on the doctrine of grace, and he's encouraged by some to publish it. And so he draws up a manuscript for this and publishes it in 1768 under the title of The Reign of Grace, From Its Rise to Its Consummation. And this work, which covers various aspects of the doctrines of grace, probably would have flown relatively under the radar had it not been for the influence of an evangelical Anglican minister named Henry Venn, who is the minister at Huddersfield. So Henry Venn gets a hold of this work. He's a pretty well-known evangelical Anglican minister of the time, has wide connections. He gets a hold of Booth's work in 1768, right after it's published, maybe even pre-publication. I don't remember exactly. But he gets a hold of the work, reads it, and initially he admits in his foreword to it that he was not very impressed with it initially. But the more he read it, the deeper he reflected on it, the more he came to the conclusion that Booth held a tremendous intellect and a sharp theological mind. And if given the opportunity to be in a situation where he could have more time devoted to study, he could be a really, really spectacular theologian. So Venn recommends that the work be published. It is published in 1768. The first edition is published in Leeds. And one thing that Venn does that will really kind of set Booth on the course for the rest of his life is he will recommend Booth's work to a number of congregations in London. Venn is hopeful that when the work becomes public and it's read by some, that it would lead to kind of a better job situation for Booth, where he's in a better financial situation, where he can devote himself fully to the pastoral ministry and to the study and writing of theology. And this is exactly what happens. In June of 1768, not long after the work is published, he is called to be the pastor of a particular Baptist congregation in London that at the time was called the Prescott Street Church. This was the oldest particular Baptist congregation in London, originally founded in 1638 by John Spilsbury. So a very, very significant and influential particular Baptist congregation there. So Booth will be ordained there in 1769 to be their pastor. And he will remain there the rest of his life until he passes away in 1806. And so a long, long period of ministry there, nearly four decades, where he will be the pastor of Prescott Street Baptist Church. And so during his time there, Booth becomes something of an elder statesman, especially as he becomes older. He will become something of an elder statesman for the particular Baptists. He is someone that younger generations of ministers such as Andrew Fuller, William Carey, will go to for pastoral counsel and advice. He writes a number of theological works while he's there. His collected works in the 1813 edition as they are published are three volumes. That includes theological works, sermons, things of that nature. And so he ministers there in London for close to 40 years. He will have a part in one of the most important socio-political movements of his day, which is the abolition of the slave trade in the late 18th century. In 1792, he preaches a sermon against the slave trade. He's not the only particular Baptist minister to do so. There are several who do so. But his is one of the, probably one of the most cited among the particular Baptists. It's really, really spectacular sermon. And so he will have a hand in that movement in the late 18th century. He will have a hand in what is eventually the founding of Stepney College in London, a training academy for Baptist ministers. And that will become what is now Regent's Park College at Oxford. And so he has a hand in the foundation of that institution. And he's someone who is, as I mentioned earlier, just remembered as a really extraordinary figure of pastoral piety. He writes a really good ordination sermon in the 1780s that kind of becomes a classic of pastoral theology among the particular Baptists. You know, unfortunately, we don't know much about the day-to-day of what his pastoral ministry looked like. We just lack that biographical detail. But we do know that he was somebody who was deeply respected by his congregation, and even outside of his congregation, as a man of, a really exemplary pastor theologian. And so in 1806, Booth dies. He had struggled with asthma, complications from that for several years. He died in 1806. He was buried at the Maze Pond Baptist Chapel burial ground, which you can't find it today because there's a hospital built over it in London. The St. Guy's Hospital in London is currently built over the site. But it's easy to find because if you go to London, all you got to do is find the Shard, the tallest building in London, right next to St. Guy's Hospital. And that's right next to where Booth would have been buried. A little fun fact here that I actually just learned today looking through the Evangelical Magazine archives was that apparently not long after Booth died, a rumor had spread that his body had been stolen from the grave. I had no idea about this until today when I found this in the Evangelical Magazine. But apparently it was serious enough that his friends actually dug up the grave and opened the coffin to verify that he was still there, and he was still there. So, yeah, you learn something new about these people even after you've been studying them for several years. And so that's Booth's life in a nutshell, someone who lives a long life of faithful pastoral ministry and someone who is really remembered, you know, who is largely forgotten today, but he's really remembered as one of the most important figures among the particular Baptists in the 18th century.
That's an amazing find, and I'm glad you found it before we recorded. So I think the two big key things we want to talk about now are primarily the context for the development of his doctrine of sanctification, which is the rise of antinomianism. So I'd love to know more about that. Particularly, I'd be really interested to see your own take on Richard Baxter, given an increased interest in his works. There seems to be a lot who have saying, no, he's not as bad as they seem. So I'm just curious what your take would be on this.
Yeah, so antinomianism is a very vast and complex movement. The term antinomian is typically attributed to Martin Luther being the one who coined it in his disputations with Johann Agricola in the 16th century. So the term is transliterated from the Greek, literally just means against the law. So in Luther's context, it was used of those who denied that the law of God continued to function as a rule of conduct in the Christian life. So in its original meaning, that is what the term antinomianism was associated with. Now, in the English context, the term antinomian kind of takes on a little bit different of a meaning that is related, but also it's more specific of a meaning. And one thing I need to note up front is that scholars of this period sometimes will distinguish between what they call doctrinal antinomianism and practical antinomianism. And so doctrinal antinomianism is primarily what I focus on in my dissertation as I'm looking at it and surveying it. And it primarily deals with a specific view of the doctrine of justification. And so doctrinal antinomianism in England, arising in the 17th and 18th century, is associated typically with men like John Eaton, men like Tobias Crisp, men like John Saltmarsh. These are all figures who are seen as important figures in the rise and development of antinomianism. If you were going to give a very simple, probably oversimplified definition of doctrinal antinomianism, you could say that it is an overemphasis on the doctrine of justification to the point of excluding man's responsibility in salvation, and especially with regard to holiness. And so with someone like John Eaton, what you will see is that John Eaton, he has a strong desire to defend the doctrine of justification by faith alone, by grace alone. But he so emphasizes the doctrine of justification that he essentially equates justification with salvation. And that is one of the kind of the ideas that will kind of hallmark antinomian thinking, is that they will place such a emphasis on the doctrine of justification that it basically encompasses all of man's salvation. And so things like sanctification, consequentially, are essentially conflated with justification. And so men like John Eaton, like John Saltmarsh, Tobias Crisp, they are seen as some of the leading contributors to these ideas. That is kind of doctrinal antinomianism. In the Baptist context, men like John Brine and John Gill will sometimes be associated with doctrinal antinomianism, mainly because of their views on eternal justification. So eternal justification is the idea that man is justified, the elect are justified in eternity past. And so based on that, they will say that the implication of it is, at least, they won't come out and say this outright, but the implication of it is, since man is justified in eternity past, then essentially one doesn't necessarily become saved at a specific point in history. Rather, they come to realize that they're among the elect, that they're justified in eternity past. So that is eternal justification, and men like Gill and Brine hold to this doctrine, and so they are typically associated with doctrinal antinomianism. Now, when it comes to someone like Richard Baxter, in his early years, fought in the English Civil War, and during his time in the English Civil War, he experienced a great deal of what scholars will typically call practical antinomianism, which is essentially a disregard for the importance of holiness in the Christian life altogether. And so his experience of that in the Civil War, in the English Civil War, Tim Cooper has written a lot on this, a lot of really excellent work. We've had him on for an episode of the podcast where he talks about this and has some really good reflections on how Baxter was essentially traumatized by the antinomianism he saw during his time in the English Civil War. And so that experience of seeing that kind of licentiousness, disregard for holy living, will really kind of influence the entire scope of his theological writing. And so when he constructs his arguments on the doctrine of justification, what Baxter will try to do is really to stress that he will really try to stress the importance of holiness in the Christian life, the importance of ongoing holiness in the Christian life. And so when he writes on the doctrine of justification, he will essentially speak of justification not as an instantaneous event, which was kind of the standard position of the Reformed tradition that comes out in their confessions of faith. Rather, he will speak of justification in terms of degrees or stages that culminate, that kind of, you know, initially begin at the moment of one's conversion and then kind of culminate in their final, in their, in what he would call their final justification at the end of their life and their glorification. And so I want to stress that Baxter's theology and his writings are incredibly complex. I'm certainly no expert on Baxter. But in my reading of Baxter, that seems to be what he is arguing. And so what I argue in the dissertation, and what I think you see in Baxter, is someone who is attempting to respond to antinomianism in his writings, really attempting to stress the importance of holiness in a Christian life. But he does so in a way that goes outside of the bounds of the Reformed confessional tradition. And so I cite him as kind of an example of someone who is attempting to respond to these things in a robust theological way, but who takes it in a direction that is not always seen or liked by those who are in the Reformed, in the Reformed tradition. So someone like Benjamin Keach, a 17th century Baptist, will write against Baxter and his doctrine of justification. He has significant issues with it. And so he's one example of someone who's attempting to respond to it. In the 18th century, in the dissertation, as I kind of move it into the particular Baptist context, in the 18th century, you have the evangelical revival in England. And along with that is kind of a renewed emphasis on the importance of holiness in the Christian life. And so if you think of a writer like someone like Andrew Fuller, Fuller will be very concerned about antinomianism, and he will write an entire treatise against the work. And so along with this 18th century evangelical revival is a renewed emphasis on the importance of holiness. And Abraham Booth will be kind of in that context as he's coming up in his ministry. He kind of comes up in the earlier years of the evangelical revival in England. He's one of the earlier ministers who is of a more evangelical bent that will become a pastor in London at the time. And so in that, what I was really trying to do is just situate Booth's own views and not just Booth, but also kind of the English confessional tradition as it emerges in the 17th and 18th century with like the Westminster Divines, the Congregationalists who were led by John Owen, the early particular Baptists, trying to situate their views kind of within this response to a growing concern over both practical and doctrinal antinomianism in the 17th century and then on into the 18th century as well. So I don't know if that answered your question, but I'm happy to follow up if you have anything you want to follow up on.
No, I think that's helpful. So I want to know now for Booth, when it comes to sanctification, I mean, one of the natural questions that I have, and I think a lot of others have, is just in what sense is this necessary? How much do you need to be sanctified? I mean, is it required in any sense?
Right. So one of the important things that you see in the English Reformed tradition, and then with Booth as well, is that they will kind of push back on this idea that justification is the only aspect of a person's salvation. Now, they will say that, of course, it is an aspect, and it's a very important aspect, and it's even maybe the most important aspect, but it's not the only aspect. And so they will affirm pretty much across the board that sanctification or growth in holiness is a necessary part of a person's salvation. And so you see that in the Westminster Divines. You see that in the writings of someone like John Owen. You see it in early particular Baptists, such as John Gill, in his writings on sanctification. And you see it in Booth as well. And the reason that they will argue that sanctification is a necessary aspect of salvation is because they're understanding all of this in the context of union with Christ and Christ's work in the covenant of grace. So they're operating from a covenantal framework that emphasizes Christ's redemptive work in the covenant of grace. And so each of these traditions, whether it's the Westminster Divines, whether it's the Congregationalists and John Owen, early particular Baptists, they will all tie sanctification to the doctrine of election and say that sanctification is an outworking of a person's election. And so for Booth, he will say that that sanctification is absolutely necessary. He has this great quote that I'll just read to you here. He says, "For though Christ is proclaimed in the gospel as entirely free for the sinner, and though we are considered as ungodly when the obedience of the righteous Jesus is imputed to us for our justification before God, yet before we can enter the mansions of immortal purity, we must be sanctified." And so one of the arguments that Booth makes, that you see in others as well, but it really comes out in Booth, is that sanctification is necessary. Real change is what he will call it, an actual transformation of a person's nature from sin to holiness. This kind of actual real change is necessary for a variety of reasons, but one very important reason is to prepare the believer for heaven. So he will clearly contrast justification from sanctification and antinomianism, doctrinal antinomianism. There's a tendency to conflate the two. But Booth and others in the English Reformed tradition will clearly distinguish between justification and sanctification. They will say that they are distinct but inseparable, and they will say that just they're different in nature as well. So justification entails a declaration of a person's righteousness. It's an instantaneous event that declares a declaration of their righteousness before God. But sanctification is a lifelong process, and it involves the actual transformation of a person's nature. And so for that reason, Booth will say that sanctification is absolutely necessary in a person's salvation. I'll just read for you one more quote here of what he says. And this is kind of just a really good summary quote of how sanctification fits within Booth's understanding of the doctrine of grace here. Speaking of sanctification here, he says, "It is the end of our eternal election, a capital promise and a distinguished blessing of the covenant of grace, the precious fruit of redemption by the blood of Jesus, the design of God in our regeneration, the primary intention of justification, the scope of adoption, and the absolutely necessary to glorification. So that in the sanctification of a sinner, the great designs of all the divine operations, respecting that most glorious work of all works, redemptions, are united." And so for this reason, Booth will say that sanctification is a capital part of a person's salvation. It's not just one aspect. It's one of the most important aspects of your person's salvation. And Booth is not alone in this. You see this in the writings of his Reformed contemporaries, those who came before him. And so you see this really, really heavy emphasis on the importance of salvation in God's, the importance of sanctification, excuse me, in God's plan of salvation.
I noticed in reading through portions of your dissertation that you did reference the new book from Tom McCall and the Friedmans. I don't know if they're brothers or father and son or not. I'm not sure. But they have that new book, The Doctrine of Good Works. And I remember thumbing through that and being very fascinated by it. So I'm glad to see interaction there. Now, an additional question on sanctification that I have is, I think you had a whole section or a chapter on how Booth understands the law to function in a perpetual sense as a sort of rule of conduct. So I guess I have a couple of questions. Number one, what does that look like? and mean in regular, you know, like if you were to talk about today. Also, is this distinct in any way from the sort of the, if you're in the reform context, you hear oftentimes the third use of the law. Is there some distinction between what Booth's doing there and something like that?
No, I don't think there's a distinction. I think what Booth is arguing is kind of right there in line with, for instance, what Calvin argues with the third or principal use of the law. And so Booth will use this language of the law being a rule of conduct. And so he will distinguish between, he affirms the typical tripartite division that's common in Reformed thinking between moral, civil, and ceremonial law. Importantly, Booth will note that there is a lot of overlap in these aspects of the law as we see them, you know, unfold. But he does see them as distinct categories, and he will argue that it is the moral law that functions perpetually as a rule of Christian conduct. And so for Booth, what is the moral law? Well, there are several things that he will kind of outline. First of all, he will say that the moral law was instituted at creation with a covenant with Adam, that it was given to Adam at creation. He will also say that it is summarized in the Ten Commandments. And so he hints at that a couple of times where he will hint at this idea that the moral law of God is summarized in the Decalogue. So he will argue that it is instituted creation is distinct from the civil and ceremonial laws that were unique to the people of Israel. It's summarized in the Decalogue, and it's also, he will argue, fourthly, that it's continuous with the law of Christ. And so essentially Booth sees one singular unchanging moral law that is constant throughout redemptive history. And he will argue that it is this moral law that is the rule of Christian conduct for believers. And Booth has he introduces this in his work, The Reign of Grace, which, as I mentioned, was published in 1768. It will go through a number of editions all the way up until his death. It's really probably the most important work for understanding Booth's soteriology. He kind of has a systematic treatment where he, you know, deals with justification, sanctification, role of good works in the Christian life. So it's a really excellent work for understanding various aspects of his soteriology. But in that work, he will argue that the moral law functions as a perpetual rule of Christian conduct. He expands on that in a work that comes out not long after the Reign of Grace called The Death of Legal Hope, or The Life of Evangelical Obedience. And in that work, Booth will basically outline a pretty comprehensive theology of law and gospel. And so in that work, Booth will argue that the moral law essentially will functions in one or two ways. It can either function as a covenant of works or as a rule of Christian conduct. Now, Booth will argue in a large portion of the work that believers are dead to the law as a covenant of works. And he will argue that unbelievers are alive to the law of covenant of works. However, he will say that believers are also alive. Believers are alive to the law as a rule of Christian conduct. It serves in one of those two capacities. And for believers are dead to the law as a covenant of works, but it continues to function in this way as a rule of Christian conduct. And it's interesting, he actually argues that the moral law's function as a rule of Christian conduct actually predates its function as a covenant of works. And so he sees it as entirely reasonable that it can cease to function in one way, but continue to function in another way. And so he will argue that the moral law is the rule of conduct for the Christian. And I'll read you a quote here, which he kind of expounds on this. Give me just a moment. Apologies. So he says the moral law is the rule of our obedience. It is a complete system of duty and is considered moral. It is immutably the rule of our conduct. And so that is his argument. Now, as it relates to the doctrine of sanctification, what Booth will argue essentially is that the moral law serves as the standard of a person's sanctification. So how is a person sanctified? They are sanctified as the Holy Spirit brings their heart and their actions in accordance with God's law. And so that plays itself out in a number of ways, but that is how he connects the two, with the law essentially being the standard of holiness that a person is held to in the new covenant. So happy to expand on that, but that's kind of just a very brief outline of his argument there.
Yeah, so that's helpful. And I guess one last thing I want to make sure that you expand a little bit on for us is a little bit, where does Booth sort of fit with the broader Reformed tradition? Would you say there are any idiosyncratic elements of his thought that he might have? Anything that's maybe, hey, this should be developed further and it's not really developed in anyone else? Or this is something maybe that wasn't so useful that it would have been better just to use traditional formulation on it?
Yeah, so what I argue in the dissertation, kind of my main argument, is that in forming his doctrine of sanctification, and I kind of look at four specific areas in my dissertation related to the doctrine of sanctification, one being the necessity of ground of sanctification, which we've discussed some, one being the nature of process of sanctification, another being the role of the law in sanctification, and then also the role of good works in relation to sanctification. So you had mentioned that briefly. Booth will essentially see good works as being the external fruit of sanctification, so as to where holiness is the internal fruit, good works will be the external fruit of sanctification, and thus he will argue that good works are an absolutely necessary part of the Christian life. But what I argue as kind of my main thesis in the dissertation is that Booth seems to draw consciously from the Reformed tradition, at least the English Reformed tradition, in his formulation of these things. It's interesting because Booth, he doesn't ever cite, for example, the Westminster Confession of Faith or even the Second London Confession of Faith. He never cites these documents. But at times his arguments will be almost word for word with confessional formulations. So he at least seems to be aware of the tradition. And it seems that to me that it is consciously informing his arguments. He does interact pretty extensively with the writings of John Owen. John Owen cited more than any other author that he interacted with. So he did interact pretty heavily with John Owen. If you read his writings on sanctification, there's pretty minimal interaction with other authors from the Reformed tradition, and he's doing a lot of his own exegetical work. But it seems to me pretty clearly that you can see the influence of historic Reformed thinking on his writing, because it's pretty evident. As I said, at times where his formulation of things is almost word for word with the confessional tradition on these matters. And so one thing that I argue with my conclusion with Booth is that with Booth, it's really probably best to understand Booth as a confessional Baptist, someone who is committed, I'll argue, to the confessional tradition of the Second London Confession of Faith. His theology clearly reflects an agreement with that tradition. As I said, again, he never cites the Second London Confession in his writings, but it's very clear that his theology aligns with it. And so one thing that I say in the conclusion, we've had works recently such as Carl Truman's book on Crisis of Confidence that reflects on the importance of maintaining a confessional faith and kind of an ahistorical age. And I really think Booth gives us a good example of how to do that. in a way that is clearly informed by the confessional tradition, but not overly dependent on it. Booth does, you know, he's a very sharp, original thinker. He does the hard work of biblical exegesis, and he wrestles with these texts of scripture himself and comes to his own conclusions. But you can see the ways in which the confessional tradition has shaped his arguments. And so in that respect, I think he's very helpful. And I do also think it helps us to understand him historically as well, because Booth has been, in studies of Booth, he has been a little bit difficult to situate historically and theologically. You will have some writers who will argue that he tends a little more towards the hyper-Calvinism of someone like John Bryan or John Gill. You will have others who will argue that he, you know, is more evangelical in his understanding of things, closer to someone like Andrew Fuller and William Carey and those guys. But I really think, at least in his understanding of sanctification, you get, you know, hinted at that. I would argue that perhaps it's most helpful to understand Booth as a confessional Baptist who kind of stands in that stream of the Second London Confession and understanding his thought. And so as far as reception of the Reformed tradition, at least as it relates to sanctification, you know, Booth pretty much wholeheartedly embraces it. There are some ways in which he makes some unique contributions, which I'll argue in the dissertation. One significant one that I point out is in his understanding of good works and the way that he applies that to the issue of the slave trade in the 18th century. In that chapter in Good Works, I deal a good bit with Booth's sermon on the slave trade, because he makes his argument, it relates to his theology of law and gospel, because he makes one of his main arguments based on his understanding of the law, but it also relates to his understanding of good works and how we are to, and how good works should be centered on the needs of others. And so I really think he's helpful in that area. But overall, I think his writings reflect a very close alignment with the larger Reformed tradition. And he gives a really good articulation of it in his writings.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I always find it helpful and interesting to see those from the past and to figure out how exactly they're coming on to their theological conclusions. Are they slavishly adherent to one particular thing, or are they being formed by multiple streams of sources? So this is super interesting. So Zach, for those who are interested in following up with you, learning more about Booth or other things, if they want more resources, where's the best place to go?
For Booth, there are a couple of sources that I would point your listeners to. There's not much written on Booth, which is one reason why I felt compelled to study him myself. We do have two printed books on Booth. One is a dissertation by Raymond Arthur Coppinger, which was written early in the 20th century. It has recently been published by Joshua Press, Canadian, small Canadian publisher, under the title A Messenger of Grace, A Study of the Life and Thought of Abraham Booth. And so it's a very good kind of introductory study of Booth, kind of gives a broad survey of his life and thought, looks at his soteriology, looks at some of his stuff on ecclesiology. So if you're wanting a good introduction to Booth, that is a good little book to start with. The other one that I would recommend is published by a particular Baptist press, and it is a collection of essays on Booth that was edited by Michael Haken. And it is entitled The First Counselor of Our Denomination, Essays on the Life and Thought of Abraham Booth. That might not be the exact title, but it's something very, very similar to that. So those are the two best introductory works on Booth that we currently have available as far as studies about him. If you're interested in reading works by Booth, there are a couple of options. So Booth's collected works were published in 1813. And the 1813 of Booth's works are available on Logos Bible Software. If you have Logos, there is a digital edition of his works on there. And then also Particular Baptist Press in Springfield, Missouri, is currently working on a new edition of Booth's works. So I'm the main editor on that series now. Dr. Haken started that project back in 2006. The first volume of that was published, which is a collection of Booth's sermons. And then when I started my doctoral work, I picked up that project. So there is one more volume of that currently available, volume two, which covers Booth's early theological works. So The Reign of Grace, Death of Legal Hope, these works that I've mentioned are available in that volume. It was released about a year ago, I think. So it's available in print. And then there will be two more volumes of that forthcoming, which will examine Booth's later theological works and then some of his writings on Baptist distinctives as well. So you can be on the lookout for that. There's not much on Booth, but one of my hopes with this project, with my dissertation, one of my hopes is that I hope that it will spur a renewed interest in Booth, that more people will be interested in him. When I went to ETS in 2022, I delivered a paper on Abraham Booth, and I think there was at least one other paper. There might have been two other papers on Booth given at that ETS in Denver. And so I've been encouraged to see and hear of more people who are interested in researching and writing on Booth. But he is definitely one of those figures where more work needs to be done.
Well, that's awesome, and hopefully that encourages somebody who's listening to go study some more on Booth. I think the only Booth stuff I have is from like the Baptist Standard Bearer. I don't know if they still exist, but I have them nonetheless.
Yeah, they reprinted some of his works. I don't know that any of them you can still find easily.
Yeah.
I've tried to find their little edition of his essay on the Kingdom of Christ, and I can't find it anywhere. So I don't know that any of their stuff is still readily available. But yeah, he is a someone who was important in his day, but has been largely been forgotten. So I am thankful to the publishers like Particular Baptist Press that are interested in reprinting some of his works. I think that'll be a valuable resource going forward.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, Zach, we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about Abraham Booth. For everybody who's been listening, as you know, you've been listening to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you all soon.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.